Resources is open. We are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2723. And Sue, why don't you give us the rundown?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2723A establishes a process by which a county or city may validate and an owner may record an established unit of land if the unit was unlawfully created by a previous owner on or before January 1st, 2007. It prohibits recording of new lot or parcel without proof that the unit of land is lawfully established, requires seller of property to disclose whether unit of land being transferred is lawfully established. And for the record, we did receive a letter from Chris Scrapetos, who has a number of concerns about the measure and offered some suggestions. And there is a proposed amendment from the realtors that would eliminate the seller's disclosure statement.
Oh, that's where that came from.
Oh.
Matt, I could use the sign-up sheets if you don't mind. Welcome, Representative.
Thank you very much. I'm Mitch Greenlick, State Representative, House District 33, one of the junior partners of the Avaki and Greenlick Bonamici trio. And,
I've heard of those people.
That's right. It's a potent group. This bill, House Bill 2723, began its journey to you during the last session of the legislature where I served on the Land Use Committee, and where Representative Patty Smith brought a constituent in that had a lot that was that they had bought many years before. They had title insurance on it. There was a house built on it. They went in for a building permit about a decade before to do something like put a fireplace on. They got their building permit. They came back a couple of years ago to get another building permit, a second building permit for a garage or for a fireplace or for something. And the county informed them that all along they had an illegal lot. And it was sort of, you know, astounding. How do we have an illegal lot? We bought it. We got a house. We have title insurance. We got a building permit. Well, that building permit was a mistake. We shouldn't have given it to you several years ago because your lot's illegal. So the question, I mean, that sounded so absurd to everybody. The question is, where do illegal lots come from? And where they come from is the ability to create tax lots independently of the planning commission in a county doing legal subdivision. So if I have 160 acres over here and I have four sons that are going to eventually get that 160 acres and I figure they're all worthless kids, they ought to at least start paying taxes on the lots they're going to get, I just create four tax lots on my 160-acre farm and I don't have to do anything except go to the assessor and create four tax lots. And now I have four tax lots. And that works fine until one of the four decides, well, I'm going to sell my lot. And they sell their lot to some unsuspecting person who hasn't checked to see whether it really is a lot. And you're going to hear some more stories today about this. And it turns out, well, that lot wasn't a legal lot. And that there was really no way to find out that it wasn't. When this couple came to Multnomah County, they lived in East County, and said, okay, we have an illegal lot, make it legal. The county said to them, we don't have the statutory authority to make it legal. Even though it could have been made legal at the time you bought it, we don't have statutory authority. So Representative Smith brought the case, and we passed a bill to make their lot legal as a one-time thing, which seemed even at the time to be pretty weird. But I promised Representative Girard and Representative Smith at that time that I would work in the interim and create a bill, and I brought in a bill that was the beginning of 2723. Well, when I brought it to the House committee, other folks said, well, yeah, that's fine. We should do that. We should have the process allow cities or counties, if they want to make lots legal. But we should also try and prevent going forward from other illegal lots being registered without making sure that they're legal. So we ended up with a work group of DLCD, I think they'll all talk to you, the cities, the counties, 1,000 friends, and the realtors to create a bill that would not only allow local jurisdictions to make lots legal under certain circumstances, but would also prevent registering deeds of lots that aren't legal. And they actually worked out what was, what seemed at that time to be a complete compromise. It turns out the realtors wanted one more thing out of it, which you have an amendment. We decided in the House committee not to give them that one more thing. They said, okay, we still, you know, we've done pretty well. We're happy with it. We won't fight it, but we wished it had what your Dash 5 amendments have now. So they are here for a second bite of the apple. All the other people are here talking about their support of the bill, including Thousand Friends and the LCD and other folks. And what I hope is you'll pass this bill and move it on. It passed the House 58-0. It passed the committee unanimously, so there hasn't been a negative vote on it yet. My preference is you pass it as it is. I wouldn't fall on my sword if you added the amendment to it, but I think, and you can examine that, I think it's probably the bill is stronger as it now stands. And
have you had a chance to see and read and study the amendments, or would it be helpful if I had? Okay.
The Dash 5. The Dash 5s are the only one that...
Right.
Yes, I have had a chance to do it. What it does is there's a section of the bill that requires in the seller's disclosure of selling real property to, as one of the checks, you know, you check, is your roof all right? Is there a lien on the house? A variety of things. Yes, no, yes, no. And one of them is the lot. Is this a legal lot? And you check yes, no. And the realtors think that's sort of hard for a seller to ascertain. And basically the notion of others was that, well, it gets them thinking about it at least as an issue. But that's basically what the, and I'm sure Mr. Levy will be here to talk about it. That's basically what they...
Actually, he's right in back of you, and I was going to say, I know you need to get to a committee, but I was going to have him come up next just in case you wanted to take a minute and listen and comment.
Sure.
Your choice. Harlan Levy?
Thank you, Chair Vakian, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. First, want to thank Representative Greenlick for bringing this issue forward and carrying it this far. This has been an issue that has been a big problem in Oregon for years, and this bill will address it, so we're very happy that it's gone this far. We do support 10 out of the 11 sections of this bill, House Bill 2723. The one section that is problematic for us is Section 8, and that is what the Dash A5 amendments would remove from the bill. The reason that we don't support Section 8, and if you look on page 7 of your bill, at lines 28 and 29, that is what is being added. It's a new question that would be added to the seller's property disclosure form, which is given by the seller in most residential real estate transactions to the buyer. And the question is that's being added is the property being transferred a lawfully established unit of land? And that is basically a legal conclusion. If you look at the definition of lawfully established on page 2, lines 24 through 32, basically that's legal. You are going to need to know how to research the statutes, how to go to the planning department, how to pull a final plat, and so on and so forth. And we just don't think that most lay people are going to be able to do that and do that correctly. And that raises the potential for them to get this wrong, which could have pretty significant ramifications down the road. So the seller's property disclosure form is a form that is supposed to be given so that the seller can tell the buyer what they know about the condition of the property. Does the roof leak? Does the plumbing work? And so on and so forth. Yes, there are some questions in there that may cross that line into legal conclusions, but we're not thrilled with those either. But we would hope that this committee would choose not to add another legal conclusion to the seller's property disclosure form because, again, that could result in misrepresentation, even if it's an unintentional misrepresentation, but that's what it would be. Furthermore, if you look, it has an asterisk next to it so that if the seller checks yes, it is a lawfully established unit of land, they're going to have to provide an explanation for how they determine that. Again, that's more problematic for a layperson. We don't think that lay people are going to know how to ascertain this. Finally, if you look at Section 7 of the bill, Section 7 is, again, one of the sections that we do support. Like I said, we support 10 out of the 11 sections. Section 7 adds some warning language to the earnest money agreement, which is the first thing the buyer is going to see when they enter into this transaction. And what it warns the buyer to do is to verify that the unit of land that they're going to buy is a lawfully established unit of land. And that way there is no representation. It's just the buyers now on notice that this is something they ought to look into, and that's where we think the notice is going to be put. So we think that that is more than adequate to put the buyer on notice that this is an issue and this could potentially be something that they want to look into. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Let me ask one question about the amendment and then Senator Atkinson's questions about the bill. On the amendment, on page 1 where it takes out the reference to 92.345 on line 1,
mm-hmm.
without me running over and grabbing the statute books, what's the purpose for that?
Chair Vakian, it says after 92.345, delete the rest of the line.
Oh, 040, so that's just getting it back to the Section 8 issue?
Right.
Section 7 and Section and 8, okay. It's just getting rid of Section 8, right?
It's just the way LC wrote the amendment. But yeah, I did hand delineate it when they
after
gave it to
delete
me.
Delete the rest of
it works out.
Sure.
So
let's
get rid
okay,
of Section
I got it.
105.
Yeah, I got it. All right, Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. Representative, in your conversations, did the issue of dual jurisdiction come up, where a piece of property has got two jurisdictions? And I think it was in 1989, I think, the legislature
tried. Both city and county.
Either both city and county or inside of a city where a partial, a portion of it is in the city, the other part is EFU and the in the county, or in some cases it's inside this water district but it's outside the UGB and the property is split right down the middle. I know there was a bunch of these called dual jurisdiction properties that were, I think in 1989 were cleaned up, but still there was I think 300 or 400 of them that were not fixed, and they're just a nightmare to get fixed. Did that come up in discussion? Will this affect it at all?
I think Ron Eber is probably a better one to talk about it when he testifies in DLCD. But remember, this bill doesn't force anybody to do anything. It simply takes away statutory barriers to cities or counties or other local units from allowing them to make an illegal lot legal. So, I think it doesn't probably have any effect on these dual jurisdiction ones.
So, just one more follow-up. So the phrase, unit of land that was created by sale that did not comply with the applicable criteria for the creation of the unit of land.
That's usually a county planning department decision on the land divisions.
So where does the burden of proof fall then under this bill? Or maybe not burden of proof. Who has the ability to fix it?
This will give whichever local authority was responsible for creating legal lots at the time the ability to fix it. It requires the owners to apply, and that is where the burden of proof comes. They need to be able to prove that it meets the criteria for being made legal, which has to do with what statutes were around at the time they bought it.
Since you bring in testifying.
Mm-hmm.
I'll save the rest of my question for the department. Thank you.
Good.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. And Harlan or Representative, either one, I guess. I'm looking at this, the amendment. And the way I'm looking at it, the bill is drafted, and Harlan, you brought this up, is the property being transferred a lawfully established unit of land, where you would hope if the buyer knows you're going to check yes, but then under this, if you check yes, you have to attach some kind of documentation that shows why you're saying yes. But the rest of these in that section are, the hope is if you're selling the property, you would be checking no, and if you check no, you don't have to, because if you check yes, it indicates there is a problem. But in this case, if you check yes, it's indicating there isn't a problem, but then you have to somehow establish that you know why, how there isn't a problem. And I'm trying to figure out how that's going to work as far as just a landowner.
Well, for most real estate transactions that are going to be houses and platted areas, there isn't any problem. And I suspect, as Harlan knows, the real estate agent is going to have to figure out how to help the seller get that information. It is a little more complicated around raw land, particularly, or land in rural areas where it's much more likely. Although I have to say, I had 6 cases in Multnomah County of this happening. So I mean, it isn't only there. Let me tell you my sense, and the reason we didn't accept this amendment, and we accepted, as you see, several other amendments in the House committee, was there had been a carefully crafted agreement between parties who don't always agree, DLCD, the realtors generally, 1,000 friends, the cities, and the counties, and it just seemed that we had manipulated it far enough. But this is a separate issue. Taking that section out won't have the house of cards falling down. It only deal with this one very specific issue, so
Well, I guess, Mr. Chair, if this was worded in the negative so that you would be hoping to check the box no and not have to then provide some kind of documentation, I could see it be easier for me to stomach. But this is going to say,
do you have any reason to believe this is an illegal lot?
Yes, something like that, because then the hope is you're checking no and you don't have to provide documentation. But in this case, if I check yes and it is a legally created lot, I then have to provide some sort of documentation to prove that. Otherwise, I haven't fulfilled the requirements of this agreement. So the way this is worded with the asterisks above, it's going to make everybody check unknown. Or
all right. Or a plat sketch, if you happen to have a plat sketch of your land.
Yeah, which is pretty odd unless you're the original owner.
I found one, actually.
Mr. Chair, may I add something?
Certainly.
Thank you for the question, Senator Beyer. I wanted to point out that realtors are not attorneys. They're not licensed to practice law, and they're licensed to practice real estate. And we are always worried about realtors that get confused and may think that they can practice law. And it would be our concern if we had members out there advising their clients as to whether or not it is a lawfully established unit of land, again, because that is a legal conclusion. In addition, you raise a very good point. This seller's property disclosure form is used in most residential real estate transactions that take place inside of cities, outside of cities. If it's a residential property, subject to several exceptions, of course, but most of them are going to use this form. So you are adding a whole new layer of complexity and potential confusion to most real estate transactions, whether they be inside of a city where this is not going to be an issue, or out in the country where it potentially could. So that's another reason why we would prefer that this section be deleted from the bill.
Senator Przanski?
Thank you. So if someone was trying to fill this form out, could they call the county deeds and records and ask them if they have a tax lot number, whether or not that was registered? And would that comply with that request?
Tax lot will not. They'd have to go to the planning division to find out whether this was created with a legal land division. It could have been a minor partition, or it could have been a subdivision, but it would, having a legal tax lot does not make it a legal lot. It's
so
odd. It's very odd.
And so if you have a property title report from the time that that person acquired the land, would that be sufficient to meet that?
No. The people who came to us with the bill that started this whole thing,
I'm just wanting some
had a title. What they would need is if they're in the city, they'd need Well, I mean, it would be easy in the city because you could get the plat for your neighborhood. That would be an easy thing to get. If it was in the county, what the bill does, in fact, is when we now record deeds, it will require proof of the legality of the lot at the time you record a deed. So in the future, finding the deed recording after the effective date of the law will indicate that proof was submitted at the time the deed was recorded. But right now it doesn't do that at all. That's the weird thing about it. So when you do a title search, you have a tax lot number frequently, and you have the recorded deeds and the sales of those deeds, but you don't know whether the lot was legal or not.
Mr. Chair.
I guess what I would say, I agree with Senator Beyer. It seems to me the way it's worded puts more of an onus on the person who's attempting to sell. But, you know, at the same time, I look at it, if we turned it around, I mean, what do we accomplish?
To me,
I don't like the way it's worded because you're going to require at least one, two, or three more steps for the person to be able to have to go down to the county, get whatever documentation there to show that it's legal. And, I mean, the easy way here is just say unknown and be done with it.
Right.
And then you haven't done anything.
Right. Or, yeah, and if you say, if we versed it around and you, do you have any reason not to believe that this is a lawfully established unit of land, and you say no, you know, I'm trying to think on the litigation component, you know, where do we gain? So.
Let me try one just to get at your intent with this section, Representative. Is what you're looking for is just type just a layman's type of warranty that it is a legal plot of land, as opposed to some kind of a legal conclusion? I'm wondering if you really don't need the documentation, but you're just looking for some type of a layman's warranty.
I this came out of the compromise. So it came out as a text. It was not in the original bill. But there is in the escrow statement in Section 8 the alert to the buyer. I think this was simply to create that option that alerted the seller that is this ever an issue. I mean, I'm sure if I were filling out, you know, my real estate agent hands me 18 pages of documents and I get to this one, it's going to be unknown. I mean, it's... I wouldn't even bother to try and make that assertion.
I'll tell you what, let's do this. Let's move on because we're going to run a little short on time. Ron Eber, Dan Eisenbeis, and Diana Bradrick. And just so the committee knows, of course, you know Mr. Eber from DLCD. Ms. Bradrick is a Washington County clerk. And I'm guessing that some of these questions might be good for them. Maybe. How are you?
I'm fine. Mr. Chair,
right
I'm Ron
ahead.
Eber with the department, and I worked with a number of the parties in helping to develop this bill and this comprehensive approach to try and deal with this problem. And I thought my task was to take you through the bill. I can do that quickly, or we can just get to the questions. We do support the bill as drafted without amendments. I can tell you, just jumping to the question at hand, the thinking of the group was that having the warning only at the escrow stage of the process is too late. You know, by the time someone's decided to sign an escrow agreement, they've decided they want to get this property and they're really into it. We wanted something earlier on, at the earliest possible point, for a buyer to get focused on this important question of whether the unit of land was lawfully established. Now, Senator Beyer makes a good point. You could word it differently. Even our feeling was, even if it's the box is checked unknown, that gets the person thinking, I need to get that question answered. I recently went through a real estate transaction, and my realtor sat me down, and we went through this disclosure statement. There were a lot of boxes checked unknown, and that simply told me I needed to get more information. As a buyer, and that it was good to get focused on that issue, because the current questions that are in there, some of which, as Mr. Levy pointed out, get you into the legal area, And so maybe you go talk to your lawyer who's helping you with the real estate transaction. But that was the thinking of the group, was to get something at the earliest possible stage for people to get focused on this question so they don't get into the kind of problems that you'll hear about from some of the other people testifying. If I might quickly to the bill, the Section 1 and 2 really deals with what we call the retroactive aspect. What do you do with these unlawful units of land that have already been created, and how can we get those validated? You did get a letter that was referenced from Mr. Skripidos in Jackson County. I've looked at that letter. A number of his concerns are actually already covered by the bill. He was concerned that by recognizing these units of land, they would get a date of creation and they would qualify for development based on the date they were unlawfully created. And the bill very clearly says that if you, once these are validated, they are validated as of this point in time. And so any benefit, development benefit based on their prior illegal creation is not there. The other aspects of the bill really deal with what we call the prospective part, and in working with the counties and AOC, and I don't see Mr. Schlack here this afternoon, there is a provision that would, as Representative Greenlich pointed out, ensure that before a deed that was creating a new lot or parcel is filed at the county clerk's office, it has to have proof, either a copy of the plat or something from the planning department that says it was a lawfully established unit of land, so we can try, as into the future, not create more of these. And jurisdictions now have existing procedures where a landowner can come in and get a legal lot verification. It's a sort of a mini land use proceeding, and they can do that. The county can either look at it and say, oh, this was platted 5 years ago, no problem, or it was a deed created long ago, and that by definition is a lawfully established unit of land. So they can get something. The clerks don't have to make any decision. They just have to have what I refer to as this magic piece of paper along with the filing that gets recorded. So with that, that's why we support the bill. This has been a long-standing problem in Oregon, where landowners come in with these units of land and they can't go forward, and this bill is designed to give clear authority to cities and counties and to allow them to recognize these units of land, or even where you can't recognize the unlawful unit of land, someone who's got a structure on it, a barn or a house that was lawfully established, they can get the permits they need to at least continue that use and move forward. So with that, we support the bill.
Ms. Bradrick?
Thank you, Chair Vaki and members of the committee. My name is Diana Bradrick, for the record, and I am the manager of records and cartography for Washington County. I'm here today representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. The clerks are not in opposition of the bill in its entirety, but Section 3 puts some recording requirements in place that are not manageable in the way that the recording process works. And the first difficulty is that the way that it reads, the clerk shall refuse to record a document for a new lot without supporting documentation. The problem is the clerk doesn't know that a deed that's being submitted is a new lot. So we don't have the documentation or access to the information. That isn't something that gets looked at. We don't have the information that says this is a new lot that's being transferred. The other problem with it is it's really a process problem. There's a requirement to attach a copy of a plat for platted land. Plat maps are 18 by 24 inches. They can't go through the recording process because of the way we have to image them. If you reduce the size, they become illegible. And the statutory requirements for recorded documents, because what's on record is an image, either a scanned-in image or microfilm, is that the document has to be legible. And there's a requirement for a certain font size. Now, we've got some suggested amendments that would correct those deficiencies that would make the process work for the recorder. And one of those is that require the proof to be on every deed that goes through, whether it be a reference to a recorded plat or subdivision by referencing the recording number rather than attaching a copy of the drawing, or get something from the planning department for unplatted land. But if it comes through on every deed, then the recorder just checks to make sure that the supporting documentation is attached and it goes through our process.
Okay, why don't you go ahead, then we'll take some questions.
Thank you.
Chair Avakian, members of the committee, for the record, Daniel Eisenbeiss with 1000 Friends of Oregon. I won't be redundant with the other comments that have been made, but 1000 Friends believes that this bill is a good bill that addresses a long-standing problem and provides certainty in the real estate market, both for people who currently possess these illegally created lots and moving forward. I would like to address some of the issues that have been raised here, though, in terms of questions. For the seller's representation statement, I think that Senator Beyer has a point that the statement could be reconfigured to lead to a no conclusion. However, that would not remove the need to do research to obtain a yes or no conclusion. It would only change whether the documents that the research would produce need to be attached to the paperwork for the property in question. And in regards to Mr. Levy's concerns that this requires realtors to come to a legal conclusion, I think that the statement that is being proposed is actually quite similar to the new statements that are on lines 38 and 39 and 43 and 44, respectively. And those statements would also require a certain amount of due diligence and checking in with the local planning department. The value of those statements is that even if they are checked unknown by the seller, it's a flag for the purchaser of the property that that is something that they need to look into. And right now, this is something that is quite simply under the radar for most purchasers, and in many cases, sellers as well. In regards to the concerns about how to produce proof that lots have been legally created, checking in with the planning department is a logical step in determining whether a lot is a newly created lot or not, and that is a process that would need to occur in order to obtain a signed statement. And a signed statement is an option that is available to the clerks if the maps, in fact, are unwieldy to attach as proof that the lot has been legally created. So I think that most of the concerns that have been raised are sufficiently addressed in the bill as it's currently configured, and I would urge you to pass the bill unamended. Thank you.
Questions, committee? Senator Atkinson.
A couple. First of all, Ms. Bradrick, do you have amendments?
I don't have drafted amendments with me today.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Eber, help me on, let's just start with the, help me understand post-transfer, the phrase post-transfer as it relates to, could that, I guess my question is, could post-transfer relate to the sale of property that was zoned two different zonings? Dual jurisdiction that I talked about earlier.
Chair Avakian, Senator Atkinson, I'm not sure about the post-transfer language, but I think in terms of a unit of land that is in two jurisdictions, off the top of my head, I think if I was trying to do something on a portion of it that was in one jurisdiction, I would go to that jurisdiction to get validation that, in fact, it was lawful if there was some question about it.
Well, that's the committee. That's the very problem. I've been on two land use issues, one of which is in Senator Bates's district, that if they are endless. They are just minefields. I've got this one piece of property that is EFU, and a third of it, or a slice of it, is zoned, ready to go, city lots inside the UGB. And the city will tell the county, which will tell the department, and the department will tell the city, which will tell the county, which will tell the department, which will tell the county to go talk to the city. And I'm telling you, these dual jurisdictions are just a nightmare. Is there a way to tighten that, fix that in this bill?
Chair Avakian and Senator Atkinson, I think if I'm understanding your question right, that's really something else. I might have a lawful parcel that's in two jurisdictions, and whether or not I can divide it may depend on what it's zoned in those two jurisdictions and whether it meets the minimum lot size, and it may require, as the law currently is, an approval from both jurisdictions, either together or separately. And I think if you wanted to figure out a way to streamline or that process or deal with it, it would have to be a separate bill. This is dealing with things that were unlawfully created before.
So unlawfully created before is what is meant by post-transfer division of land?
Could you tell me where that language exactly is?
The relating clause. I'm trying to give it some purpose here. Looking at the relating clause.
Mm-hmm. Senator Atkinson, that goes back to the original relating clause before we amended the bill, and it was just dealing with these things that have been transferred at some point in time and were unlawfully created.
So can I ask Senator Pruszynski a question? Are you tracking with me on my issue here?
Yeah, what I'm hearing is that the issues that constituents have when they're in dual jurisdictions, how are they ever getting anything accomplished as to trying to divide it out for ourselves, what I think I'm hearing.
Yeah, but would that apply, and would a remedy apply in this relating clause?
That's not my bailiwick, so I don't know what the relating clause.
Let me take...
Ask LC for opinion here.
What's that?
Could we ask LC to explain that? I mean, I know what you're talking about. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Post-transfer division of land, I don't know if that works.
I don't know if it works either.
Let me tell you what I'd like to do. Let's see first if there's any other questions of these three. I know you need to still get yours answered, but we're not going to get answered right here.
Okay.
So, no? Ms. Broderick, what I'd like you to do is leave your contact information with Mr. Davis before you leave. Okay. We know where to find the other two of you if we need to. Yes.
If I might briefly share, you know, we had worked with Art Schlack from the Association of Oregon Counties on this language and understood that he had coordinated it with the Clerks Association. We think this is an important aspect of the bill. I'm pleased to hear that the clerks think with some amendments we can make it workable from their standpoint, and we're more than amenable to talk with them and try and work that out.
I think what I'd like to do, we've got three other folks that are going to testify, and I'm going to want to hear you today. I think what I'd like, Senator Beyer, if you're willing and have the time to do it, if you wouldn't mind just taking a look at the various concepts that have been proposed to us today for amendments, sort through them, see which ones maybe we need to include. Maybe you'll need to get in touch with Ms. Broderick and Mr. Eber and Representative Greenlick. And let's reschedule this thing either for Thursday or the following Tuesday and see if we can put it together. You mind?
No problem.
Okay, terrific. But to finish out the testimony today, Mr. and Mrs. Wilson, if you could come up. And Glenn Archambault.
Issue more.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Welcome.
Welcome. Yes.
You want to just go ahead and state your name for the record and go right ahead.
John and Shirley Wilson, Cottage Grove, Oregon. I've got a. You got the letter yet?
Oh, he's got it here.
I'm going to go ahead and just read this. It's short and it'll get a cover the
point. Yeah, go right ahead.
I'm writing in support of House Bill 2723. My bride and I find ourselves in the same boat as the people in Jackson County who ended up with the illegal land partitioning, as reported in the Capitol Press, March 30th, 2007. We bought 38 acres to build a log home and retire on. And this was a 40-acre tract with 2 acres taken out in August 26, 1974. Prior to our purchasing the 38 acres, if it had gone through planning, it could have been divided into 2 20-acre tracts at that time. Since 2003, we've been trying to obtain a building permit. The last time I talked with a planner, I was told that all they needed was a legal lot and a good building blueprint to give us a building permit. Everything else, zoning, roads, septic site, template test, all the other things, they were okay. I'd be happy to give you more details if you'd like to hear the long version of this plot. I am now 70 years old and hope to build if we can get a legal lot. Thank you very much for your consideration. I have a P.S. down here. The 2 acres, it has gone through 3 different owners with a variance from the county to put a double-wide modular home on the 2 acres. And we are the second owners of the 38 acres, and none of us are related. So I would like to see this committee pass this. As my county commissioner told me, he said the only solution we have for you folks is a legislative solution for us. So,
very good.
Thank you.
Ms. Wilson, did you want to add anything?
Oh, my bride.
Glad yeah. You're here anyway. All right.
Okay.
Mr. Archambault, you're up then.
Did you hear?
No.
He called me his bride.
Yeah.
Yes. After 23 years.
Yeah. Part of the permanent legislative record right there. He can't get out of it now. Yeah, but we can go ahead and wait right there just in case there's questions.
My name is Glenn Archambault. I'm from Phoenix, Oregon, and I'm also an owner of an illegal parcel of land. There's a number of us in the state, and here are some of my friends, my new friends here. I have a brief PowerPoint presentation I have for you, and I want to summarize a couple of things real quickly here. I've spent 14 years at this issue. I've spent many, many years in court, in district court, in the Court of Appeals. I've sat before a jury. I've been through the real nuts and bolts of what you guys are talking about today. You know, I got that disclosure statement. I went to the county planners. I did all of those things. So one of the reasons I'm here today is not so much to talk about being a lawyer and creating a bill, but the reality of what you're talking about, the average Oregonian sitting down and buying a piece of property.
Give me some idea of how brief your brief presentation is.
Pretty brief.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll just go with that.
Okay. That's a piece of farmland, and it has an illegal lot in it. Looks like a lot of farmland in Oregon. And buried down there is a couple of illegal lots, actually. And there's a real estate flyer, like many real estate flyers. I'm going to be very blunt. It was full of nonsense. Nothing else I can say there. That's a decision by the county hearings officer about these parcels of land. Very final. He knew what he was doing. He was a good attorney. He made this decision. You can find these records in the county central files, or you can get them online. If you have a computer and you know how to run it, you can find that document and many documents like it at a county planning department online, or you can walk in the door. It's not a hard process to do. So when someone's trying to learn something about their property, actually our counties are very good about records. You might notice no permits allowed. Now, that's one of the big issues about illegal lots. It means they take basically all the rights away, whether it be farmland, a new house in downtown Portland, industrial land. You have no rights to it. We did all of this. We had title insurance, a disclosure statement, a real estate attorney, a standard Oregon real estate contract, a full review of land and improvements by the county planners. When we bought this farm in 1993, we were very competent people when it came to farms and land. We didn't leave anything to chance. We could not detect this was an illegal parcel. The sellers and the creators knew exactly what they were doing. Now, on that side, they were pros. But I want to make sure you remember, we did all of those things. And I'll add this. We did this last night with my 16-year-old son, so any errors or anything, I'll blame it on him. I think some of those points are important. You're welcome to ask me a question about what actually happened when I was buying the property.
Yeah. He's a good guy.
As you can see, there's some important people in our real estate community there that are described and discussed, particularly mortgage companies and title companies. They're an interesting group when it comes to the illegal partition issue. And last week, that was a mortgage property that's in the illegal division. It was filed in one of our larger title companies, no problem at all. The property that's being described here has been through everything you can think of as far as review. It's a final decision, yet they were able to get title insurance and able to get a 30-year adjustable rate mortgage without any problem at all, and there's no discussion whatsoever from the title company that the property is illegal. Again, anyone who can run a computer can look this property up in Jackson County and find out that you got some real problems.
Okay.
Folks, have any questions?
Very good. Committee, any questions?
Yeah, I'm just baffled at hearing this, that you can actually go through this process, think you've got something legitimate, only to find out that you don't. And I'm curious as to, in your situation, the sellers, based on your statements today, knowing what they were doing, what, if any, sanctions or remedies did you seek, or are you seeking them? Or
I'll give you a brief summary. We filed a civil lawsuit against the sellers of the property for this issue and several others. And in a lower court decision, the judge said that the disclosure statement is just confetti, and the issue of the standard real estate contract that everyone buys property in this state, that it was an issue of fraud and not of breach of contract. The Court of Appeals reversed that decision and said, no, it's not a fraud issue. It's an issue of breach of contract. But we were not able to sue the party in a lower court decision in front of a jury. The jury said, we see no harm from what was done to you. So there was no solution there. And the big lesson in the state of Oregon, and this court case is well known in the legal community, is that in the end, you can just simply put barbed wire around a parcel of property and sell it, and there's nothing that's going to happen to you as things stand today.
Title, if I can follow up, you get title insurance on this?
Oh, yes.
All right. And then what are they insuring?
Well, usually title insurance, and I'm not an attorney, but I'm a pretty knowledgeable guy in this issue, they're looking back for liens, that sort of thing. Did the previous owner, you know, pay off the mortgage? Did you pay the plumbers or anybody out there that's looking to harm, generally, the lender? They're looking to provide protection to the lender, not the buyer of the property. And so the title company, and the last document I showed proves this, they never go to the planning department in any form whatsoever and check the property out. This property that I bought was well known to many of the planners. There were documents showing it was an illegal parcel. They never got their act together to show my attorney that problem. But even once these parcels had been dragged through all the court process it had been through, still a title company doesn't look at this issue. So it lends a level of legitimacy to the property and the transaction that is just not reasonable.
Well, I'm sensing, too, that even if everybody in the chain does their job exactly right, you could potentially solve a problem, right?
That's a long chain, but yes. Some of this is not ever going to get solved in law. This is going to be a professional level of responsibility.
All right. Anything else, committee?
Just a couple of questions real quickly.
Go ahead.
Glenn, thanks for coming up today. I know this has been an important issue for our entire county. I don't know why we have a sort of epidemic from the 1970s in our county, but, boy, we've got them everywhere. And I can probably rattle off five or six cases of people I know who are going through the same thing and just found themselves in a quagmire they can't get out. Do you think that the time this property was sold to you that the real estate agent knew this was going on?
Absolutely. And I'm going to say something, Senator Bates. That's not, you know, a wholesale black eye on the real estate community. There's some great realtors out there, very professional, but these people did know. But they had no sense of pain and suffering coming their way for doing this.
Well, there probably wasn't any.
No, there wasn't any.
Do you see a problem for real estate agents if this bill goes through where they'll be held liable for something that they might not know themselves either?
No, actually, it would provide considerable protection because one of the things that clause in the disclosure statement that was discussed, it would get buyer and seller, their realtors, their attorney, you know, the cat and dog, all down to the planning department and start going through those documents and understanding their property. And that would really protect the realtor and the seller. And I think most realtors would agree with me. They don't want anything to do with messes like this. But one of the things from years of experience, I see people do not use our planning department. And we got great people down there. They got tons of information. Go down and ask them. They've got a lot of legality in Jackson County. You simply go in and they'll go through this for you.
Mr. Chair, one last question.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you agree that most people, when they're buying property or a home, once they run through the title company, they're given about 20 sheets to sign, most of which they can't understand.
That's right.
And they just go ahead and take the word of the real estate agent, things are straight, because they trust the real estate agent, and they trust the title company having done its job, and they sign off for everything, but these kind of things can be in there, and they don't know about it. Is that what you're telling us?
That's true of both sides. The title officer, the realtor, the buyer, seller may not realize that. Often someone does. I think that there's a level, you know, you're sitting there, your nervousness can be, you're buying this property, it's everything you own. And I think what Ron Eber was saying earlier, that you want to get this issue out way beginning in the game. You don't want to be sitting at the title officer and start going, you know, gosh, is this illegal? We want to know that when we're first looking at the property. So I think that little clause in that disclosure statement is very important, so that we don't get to the title company and to the mortgage company and start going over these issues.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Glenn, thanks for coming up here.
Thank you.
I have a question. I got a statement, though. Senator Beyer is going to be working on this, from what I understand. What I'm hearing, I mean, this is a real travesty, and it seems to me that I'm more than willing to hold the seller accountable. I also think that there should be some responsibility for anyone that's in that process of selling that property. I mean, there's a due diligence here, and if you're getting compensated for putting property on the market, and in your case, knowing that it was not a legal lot, they should be held accountable just like the seller. That's one way to enforce, you know, the policing. And I mean, if someone's getting paid, and this is, you know, all respect to realtors, I mean, I've always would be relying on them to be helping me if I was selling my property or buying property to walk me through this process. There's someone that does it on a day-to-day basis, and I think it would be beneficial to know at the very beginning whether or not the realtor is dealing with someone of integrity who's trying to sell the property, and for the buyer to know what they're getting ready to step into has some type of let's say the buck stops here ramifications for those people who are trying to sell something that's illegal. Because I mean, clearly what I'm hearing is this is unconformed use of the property, and then in your case you're stuck with it.
Right, that's right. As is the taxpayer also. Right. I should remind all of you that the taxpayers of Jackson County and the people of the state of Oregon have spent a vast fortune on my farm trying to figure this out. But I agree with what you're thinking about. You really need to get everybody involved, responsible, and responsible parties will go to the planning department. We've got great planners. They'll answer your questions. But if you don't go there, then you've got a problem.
Okay, time to move on.
All right.
Committee, thank you, everybody, for who came and testified. Very helpful to the committee, and we will be back again with the issue. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2723, open a public hearing on House Bill 2187. Sue, if you could. Gail Shibley, if you could come up to the table.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2187 authorizes the Department of Human Services to impose fee on water suppliers for the cost of conducting sanitary surveys.
And I note, Ms. Shibley, that in the position boxes here that you marked the four box with an exclamation mark. Maybe we should start there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Gail Shibley, Administrator of Environmental Public Health for DHS. And it's a pleasure to be with you today in strong support of safe drinking water, unapologetically so. House Bill 2187, the 19 words in the single sentence that it comprises is the product of 2 years plus worth of work by a statewide bipartisan volunteer task force that was formed at the direction of then-Chair Jensen's 2003 House Water Committee. That task force was extremely diverse, representing all kinds of interests and organizations with various stakes and perspectives and concerns and priorities in terms of protecting and providing drinking water in Oregon. The task force identified the workload for public health in Oregon to effectively administer the Safe Drinking Water Acts, both at the federal, as required by the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act, as well as by state statute and ORS 448, and also looked at the fundings and the priorities for the work itself. Not just good work should happen, but in terms of prioritizing, as I know the chair is very interested in and appropriately concerned about, really took several sharp pencils to saying, if we could only do one thing, what one more thing or what one better thing would that be, and went on down the list in that way. And House Bill 2187 is the product of that. Over and over and over again by the water suppliers, water providers themselves, they made it quite clear that providing objective, trained, skilled, experienced public health sanitarians on site on a regular, predictable basis to provide information, oversight, and a report was of such value to them as water providers that they were willing to do the unthinkable and open up their wallet every time one of those reports was due, which under the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act is every 5 years for sources strictly groundwater, and 3 years for any drinking water sources that are under surface water. So we know how important sanitary survey inspections are from a public health standpoint. This task force report, which you have in front of you as well, confirmed that sanitary surveys are important to the providers and to the consumers that they serve as well. The last point that I just want to leave you with in terms of what this bill does and what it represents is that it is important in and of itself. It is even more important because it is a component of, for the first time in the history of the state of Oregon, fully funding drinking water protection and oversight, both, again, for the federally regulated or those systems subject to federal regulation, as well as those subject to state regulation that has been on the books and, frankly, has not been carried out, period, by state or local public health, despite it being a state statute in 4S448. So this, as I said, this was a committee bill in 2005. It came back. It passed out of the Water Committee. Kind of got hung up in other corners in the House. Was reintroduced. Former Chair Jensen carried this bill on the floor of the House. There were, of course, it's the nasty F word. I'm sorry, I'm going to say a four-letter F word of fees, and consequently, it did garner some
right over the edge there.
Some no votes on the floor of the House. No question about it. But frankly, we wouldn't be here taking up your time talking about that nasty F word if it weren't worth, weren't important to public health, and if the drinking water providers didn't see and second that support as well. You have, I think, in just to kind of go through some of what you are deluged with there, you have not only, of course, my sterling testimony, but also the testimony from last February on the House side of League of Oregon Cities, also the Special Districts Association, League of Oregon Voters, and there were several others as well. This was a consensus product by the members, just wanted to also point out to you in terms of these little legislative snapshots, in terms of the environmental perspective, that we view Oregon. We look at how many water systems are out of compliance. We've got well over 100 that are currently out of compliance that we know about. We've got a whole bunch more that, frankly, we just don't know about. And we think that people deserve to know and be able to rely on safe drinking water. So I know we've got some other folks here who are willing and able to testify in support. They said Willie Tiffany, at least earlier, was here from League of Oregon Cities, Amanda Rich from Special Districts. I think there's some other written testimony in support as well. No, there is no organized opposition. I ask your aye vote. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions? No. I'm going to move to a work session, okay?
Let's do it, yes.
All right, then close the public hearing at 2187. Thank you, Ms. Shibley. Open up a work session. If I could have, on 2187, if I could have a motion.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 2187 to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Ask it a Ways and Means, probably, isn't it? No,
nope.
It's a P.
Nope.
To the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Bates. Moving House Bill 2187 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered, and the chair would be happy to carry the bill. Thank you, Ms. Shibley. I'll close the work session on 2187. Open the public hearing on House Bill 3188A. And McConnell, Houston, and Lynch can come up while Sue reads the...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3188A clarifies authority of Department of Geology and Mineral Industries related to the permitting of oil and gas operation, modifies and adds definition, establishes a fee.
They're all deferring to you, Mr. Lynch.
Chair Varkey and members of the committee, thank you very much for your time. House Bill 3188 brings us up to speed in the oil and gas industry. The most striking component of this is a significant fee increase. We haven't had a fee increase in this program since 1989 to 91. We have a significant workload that has increased in the last year or two. But it's an important development that's occurring in Coos Bay. We held a governing board meeting there in 2005. We held a public information meeting in January of this year, January 29th. We are a fee-based regulatory program. We regulate the mining industry and the oil and gas industry. And the cold, hard facts are that right now the mining industry is subsidizing the oil and gas industry. Excuse me. This bill changes the fees, improves the environmental protection of drilling, deep drilling for natural gas. It increases and improves interagency coordination. It clarifies technical language that only occurs in the oil and gas industry and brings it, and finally brings us up to speed with our own APA. I think the most important part of this bill is that we went to the three natural gas producers in this state. Two of them are currently producing Northwest Natural Gas, Energen Resources. There's one that hopefully soon will, in their minds anyways, and in ours as well, will be producing gas, and that's Methane Energy Corporation, based in Coos Bay. The Methane Energy Corporation is looking at a target that would produce, and I have to correct my own testimony, in the second paragraph under introduction, the 1.2 billion cubic feet should be changed to 1.2 trillion cubic feet. If that potential is realized and it's headed that way, that would supply the energy needs of the 1.5 million households in Oregon for 10 years. But it should be, it's important that be done in an environmentally protective way. And we think this bill, and I need to say, all three of the producers support this bill and have from the get-go and have been great to work with. We have no opposition identified. The community itself of Coos Bay, where the new development is occurring, is in support of the bill. Interestingly, they say the comments to myself and, excuse me, Bob Houston, who I didn't introduce, who is our oil and gas program right now. They were very open in their support of the company. Their fear was, well, what if they leave and somebody else gets it? And then they said, well, that's the importance of good regulation. We should be...
Well, let's run and see if we've got any questions for you.
Thank you.
Just one question real quick. Where is the drilling actually occurring in Coos Bay?
South of Coos Bay, and between Bandon and Coos Bay, but closer to Coos Bay.
It's on land?
Yes.
10 miles south.
Is 10 miles south.
They've actually got a gas field there that's that big?
It's an old coal bed. And down around 4,000 feet. It's a relatively new, it's considered unconventional energy. It's relatively new in the United States, and their exploration so far has been very positive, and we need to catch up the regulation with their drilling.
And this is a natural gas field?
This produces natural gas, yes.
And is there anything going on around that permit like they're doing in Wyoming where they're pumping steam in and affecting the environment, or just a straight well?
This is a deep well that, and basically what happens, that methane is stored in a coal deposit. And as you relieve the pressure, the gas comes up through, you capture the gas and tie it into a pipeline and...
And away you go.
And away you go.
And this is not kind of stuff that's going on in Montana and Wyoming then?
It is related to it. Their drilling is much shallower, and there are certainly their concerns in the west, in the Powder River Basin, is more of a surface water issue. There's somewhat of an advantage to being deep here. These are in non-potable waters. They'll bring that up, and disposition of that water is critical. That would, and they are currently pursuing a individual NPDES permit with DEQ.
Tell you what, we've got one more bill to hear, so unless it's a significant question, let's go ahead and move on. Thank you, Mr. Lynch.
Thank you.
I'll close the public hearing on 3188, open a work session on 3188.
Mr. Chair,
mm-hmm.
We have House Bill 3188A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Prozanski. Moving 3188A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to give you a courtesy yes vote. I think it's a great bill, but I have some concerns that have not been answered today, and I need to find out about them because I know what's going on in the Powder Basin in Wyoming, Montana is an ecological disaster occurring out there. And I'm assuming that's not occurring with this bill. And I'm getting lots of nods. Yeah, it's not. So on that basis, I'm a yes.
Okay. That sounds like I cut you off one question too soon.
No,
sorry
okay.
about
I'll
that,
find
Senator.
Out, I'll find out my own time.
Any objections?
Okay.
Seeing none. So ordered, Senator Prozanski, if you don't mind carrying the bill.
Sure.
And close the work session on 3188. Open up a public hearing on 3494. Lauren Henderson, if you could come up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3494A authorizes the Department of Agriculture to receive and distribute grant funds for any purpose related to the laws administered or enforced by the department, revises language related to contracts.
For the record, Lauren Henderson, Assistant Director with the Department of Agriculture. I will be very brief. This bill was introduced by Representative Krieger and Representative Boone on our behalf as a result of our participation in the Salmon Assistance program and the allocation of those funds to the affected fishers on the coast because of the lack of the season. The Department of Justice asked that we put a little bit more clarification in our existing 561 statute that actually had the word grant in it. This bill does nothing more than allow the agency to accept and also issue grants. And a good example that some of you may be aware of is our Noxious Weed Control Program does that as well.
Questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on 3494A. Open a work session on 3494A.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 3494A to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Atkinson. Moves 3494A to the floor with due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And Senator Atkinson, you want to carry that one?
Be delighted.
And with that, close the work session on 3494A. And we are adjourned.
So the phone's ringing.